thank you so much for being with us today.
That's okay, Rich. It's a pleasure.
My goodness, the first volume of your trilogy, all these years, Volume 1, Tune In, was so incredible, so thoroughly researched, and now an extended special edition. What kind of details might we look for as we read even more from the early years of the Beatles?
Well, that's a good question. The book is, I originally wrote this book with 780,000 words, which is a hell of a lot of words. And I had to trim it down for the mass market edition. So the book that most people have is actually a bridge. They may not have realized it because it was done quite deftly, but it is actually abridged. So now the full Everything I Wrote edition is going to be fully available in the States for the first time. And it just has more levels and layers of context and color, more about their family backgrounds, more about their childhoods and teenage years, more about rock and roll and rhythm and blues and the music they were listening to, more about the music business, more about Brian Epstein and George Martin in particular. That's the Beatles manager and the Beatles producer, of course. So just more of everything. I mean, the real challenge for me was getting that down to about half the size for the abridged edition. But I managed to do it in such a way that it left no gaps. But when you see this book, the full edition, then you will realize that actually quite a lot of it was cut out.
There have been so many books written about the Beatles, but you've said before, and I would agree, there's never been until this volume a truly comprehensive biography of the band that really looks at it from several different perspectives. Why was it important for you to tell this story and to tell it in such an incredibly thorough way?
Well, the earliest biography of the Beatles came out in 1968 by Hunter Davis. That's the authorized book. And in its time, it was a seminal work. And that's now almost 50 years ago, 50 years next year. There haven't been that many biographies of the Beatles since then. There have been maybe a handful. Most books on the Beatles are other kinds of books, books that look at their records or their photographs or their art or whatever it might be. But in terms of biographical work, and in particular, as I see it, in terms of writing the Beatles as a history, it's really not been done, certainly not to the extent that I always believed it ought to be done. I said that the Hunter Davis book is 50 years old. That is proof, if anywhere needed, that the Beatles are still extremely important. We recognize now more than ever before their contribution to our culture, and we revere them as much now, if not before, for the extraordinary qualities in their work and in their personalities and so on. They really were responsible for making pop music, rock music, whatever you want to call it, for actually beginning its maturity from its earliest days when it was just this kind of teenage thing. The Beatles, in a sense, helped elevate it to the, I hesitate to call it art form, but it is. It's exactly what it actually is. So they are worthy of proper study, and it's important, in my view, that the history is actually got right while it's still possible to do it. Because if it's not got right now, it will very likely be wrong forever. And I don't want to go to my grave knowing I could have done something about it but didn't. So this is my chance to try to ensure that we appreciate the Beatles in the future, long after we're all gone, for the best of reasons, and that anybody studying them actually gets it right.
Now, is it true that George Harrison once, I guess, confronted, maybe too strong a word, but challenged you because you weren't present and perhaps couldn't offer an accurate history simply because you were not there?
Yes, he did. He did. He said it to my face, and then he said it in another circumstance that was actually meaning me, but looking across the room at me. Yeah, he did say that. That was his view. You weren't there, so how could you know? Or you weren't there. How could you know? And that's my impression.
It was very good.
Thank you. The thing is, if biography was only written by people who were actually witness to events, there would barely be any biographies on the shelf. There is a role for biographers, and certainly for historians, to look at a subject as thoroughly as possible, to use every possible piece of information or eyewitness to get it right. But there is always that worry, and George was correct to point it out. There is always the worry that if someone who wasn't present writes about events, and they may not be getting it entirely right, but I am doing all that I can. I'm spending 30 years on this trilogy of books to get it as right as possible. And that comes on top of many previous years of doing research. So though I respect and understand George's position, I think I'm actually honoring the Beatles and honoring his memory by doing all I can to ensure that anyone who's trying to study his life and his work actually does have a chance to get it more right than usual. So if George is listening from wherever he might be now, then that's my message.
We're talking with Mark Lewison, a Beatles biographer, the author of All These Years, Volume 1, Tune In. And one of the many things I learned from Volume 1 is that much of what we think we know about the Beatles are stories that have been told and retold, but may not be accurate. And I've heard you say in interviews before that you did not set out to debunk any myths, but the meticulous research has revealed some things. And one of them is the story of the Beatles coming together with George Martin, perhaps not being what we've heard. Could you talk about that and the role of a man by the name of Kim Bennett?
Ah, that's a good question. Yeah, you see, the Beatles story has been told very, very often. People think they know it, but actually they don't know it because things got either intentionally or unintentionally sewn into the fabric of this story a very long time ago. And all they've done, all the books that have been published since have done, is actually cement those things further and further into truth. But they're not true. I wasn't trying, as you just said, to set out and disprove myths, but merely by getting the story as right as possible and researching it much better than it's, or deeper than it's been researched before, the myths do tend to fall away. In the case of the Beatles getting their all-important record contract, if this hadn't have happened, we wouldn't know who they were. If they hadn't have started to make records, we wouldn't be talking about them now. That all happened really as a result of George Martin being assigned the Beatles for various reasons, which I do go into in complete thoroughness in the book. He was kind of told to give them a recording contract by a more senior level of management within EMI Records in London for whom he was working. So he didn't sign them thinking they were great. He actually signed them without even meeting them. But the beauty of the fact that this was George Martin and they were the Beatles is that when he met them, he recognized straight away that actually these people were going to be interesting to work with. They had not so much at that point their music that impressed him, but their personalities and their sense of humor and their unconventionality, if there is such a word. It's so easy now to forget, but before the Beatles, there wasn't really anybody else like the Beatles. There were very few, if any, three rock bands with three guitars and drums, and three of them at the front line singing, and in particular, two of them writing the songs. This just was simply not done. It became the way that it would always be done, but at that time, it wasn't done. It was the Beatles who created that. So when George Martin met them, he recognized straight away that they weren't usual. They were unusual. They were different from the rest. And within months of meeting them or having been assigned to meet them and to sign them, he realized that they were unlike anybody else, and they recorded what would be their first number one single, Please Please Me. They gelled immediately. He was the right man for them, and they were the right group for him. But initially, it was extraordinary piece of luck that they fell into each other's arms.
And in many ways, Mark, also an extraordinary piece of luck that they made it to the point where they could take both the United Kingdom and the United States by storm, because I was surprised to learn that along the way, there were some times, well, they did break up on a couple of occasions, and there were ample opportunities for the whole thing to dissolve.
There were. I mean, the Beatles always had this thing about something will turn up, but there were moments along the way when it really didn't look like they would have any kind of breakthrough. And also the Beatles themselves, the restlessness that they always had within their artistry, if you like, which is one of the things that propelled the extraordinarily fast progression of their musical sound once they were making records. That restlessness was always there. So they were never going to do anything for any one time. People say, when did the Beatles begin to break up? And my kind of, it sounds like a kind of smart ass answer, but my answer is really that they began to break up the moment they got together, because those guys were never going to do any one thing forever, because it was within their DNA that they always wanted to move on and keep trying something else. And eventually that would encourage them to be doing different things entirely. Now, I realize I didn't answer the previous bit of your question about a man called Kim Bennett. So I will just quickly go back and add the fact that Kim Bennett was a man in London about whom no one really, apart from readers of this book, will have any idea of who he was. He has now died, but I had the privilege of interviewing him about 12 years ago now for this book. And he was the one man in London who believed in the Beatles when nobody else was. He was their first believer. Actually, he was just one of those doggy personalities who worked in the music publishing business. And it was through his perseverance that A, the Beatles got their contract with George Martin, and B, that their first record, Love Me Do, got into the charts and stayed there, because he was the one who kind of made sure that it got some radio airplay and things like that. He went to extraordinary lengths. The Beatles never met him. I don't think, unless they've read this book, I don't think they've even heard of him. And nor is anybody else who thinks they know the Beatles until they read this book, because without Kim Bennett, as so often happens, he was the cog in the chain. And if you remove him from the chain, then the whole thing falls apart.
You've said in the past that Volume 1 is very much a Liverpool story. How much impact did that upbringing in post-war Liverpool have, obviously on the guys as individuals, but on the band and its approach to music?
It was very significant. The Beatles were all war babies, and war in Liverpool was devastating, because it was a target for the Luftwaffe bombers from Germany. They tried actually to obliterate Liverpool off the map. It was one of the most important ports and docks in the British Empire, and it was a major target for them. And so although the four Beatles as war babies lived to see peace, the city as a whole, the one that they grew up in, was devastated. It was like a war zone. And they grew up in amid rationing and bomb sites everywhere, and a lot of poverty. The Beatles themselves were not particularly from poor families, but no one there had much money, and it shaped the character of the people in that city. But it didn't quench it, and in fact it made them very resilient. And Liverpool has always been a musical city. It is to this day, principally because of its strong Irish heritage. And the Beatles themselves, three of them of the four, have Irish backgrounds. And they grew up in a musical city. And it happened to be, once the late 50s rolled around, the only place in the world, and I mean the world, even including America, that had a real thriving rock and roll scene, with live groups playing every night in different halls and different ballrooms and so on. It's sufficient eventually for the place to have its own music paper called Merseybeat. No one else was paying any attention to what was going on there, but within Liverpool there was a lot of competition, and the Beatles had competition but very quickly rose to the top. As soon as they had their first trip to Hamburg in Germany and came back to Liverpool, they were the best. And they reached the top in Liverpool pretty quickly after that, but then hit the ceiling and couldn't really go anywhere else until they got Brian Epstein as their manager. And he was the one who got them out of Liverpool and into London and then into the whole of the UK and then eventually, of course, the world.
Well, Volume 1 gets us through 1962. I know the research has been going on for years and years into the rest of the story. Do you have a target date for Volume 2?
I've got a target date. I mean, people often ask me when the next book is coming out, and I always say, which is true, that I'm aiming for 2020. However, I'm not sure that I'm going to hit it. It's still my aim, but it's looming large now, being that we're coming close to 2018. I have a feeling I'm not going to get it out in 2020, but I'm not dragging my heels on this, because after Volume 2, I've then got Volume 3 to write. And I think it's looking likely that by the time this project is completely done, I will have spent the best part of 30 years on it. And it is all I do. I have nothing else to do. It is my job. And I'm privileged to be the one who is spending pretty much a life writing about the Beatles. But I'd like to get it finished and get it out. So no one should think I'm just dragging my heels. But it is a massive task. It really is an absolutely massive task. And I'm still pretty much functioning alone. And I do all my own research and all my own writing. And it's a multifaceted book because, in essence, the three books together are like a very comprehensive history of the 1960s, and not just in Liverpool, not just in London or even Britain, but America too, and indeed the rest of the world. So it's a complex book to write, but I'm not complaining about that, but it is taking time.
Well, I absolutely devoured volume one. I look forward to all 1,728 pages of the expanded, extended special edition. And I thank you so much for your work and your passion for this project, which has been so wonderful for all of us who love the music and who love the individuals involved. And thanks so much as well for spending time with us today.
That's a pleasure. You have delayed the next book by about 20 minutes, but I won't hold it against you.
All right. Others can blame us for that, but we're happy to do it. Thank you again, Mark.
Thank you.